Hello and welcome to the Jerusalem Post podcast. I'm your host, Tamar Oriel Berry, joined by my co-host, Editor-in-Chief Avi Meir. Avi, oh boy, what a week it's been.
What a week it's been. Really, what a month it's been.
What 2 months it's been, really? But the past week has seen some of the most extreme changes in terms of the state of the war that we've seen since the first day, since the October 7th massacre.
That's true. There have been high highs and low lows, and there's still a great deal of uncertainty about the path ahead. I think, you know, it's obviously exhilarating to see hostages being returned to their families, but of course there's deep anxiety about the well-being of those hostages who remain in captivity, as well as significant concerns about those terrorists who are being released as part of this deal. As we know, those released in the context of these deals have a tendency to re-enter the cycle of terror. Yahya Sinwar, of course, is the leader of Hamas in Gaza and was the mastermind behind the October 7th massacre, was himself released as part of a previous prisoner exchange. And so I think there's very significant concerns about that, alongside, of course, the jubilation of families being reunited.
Right. It's kind of a dichotomous sense of both relief and fear, because ultimately the goal of this war, once it had broken out, was to finish Hamas once and for all, not let this terror organization continue its horrifying reign. And yet we are releasing its operatives, these people who have committed themselves to a life of jihad, who have committed themselves, attempted murder in every which way. And those are the people that we're releasing back to ultimately join this organization. At the same time, it feels like there's nothing that could stop us. There's nothing that would make it not worth it to bring our innocent civilians that were kidnapped home. We've had dozens released so far, more and more every day as the ceasefire goes on. At this point, at the time of recording, the ceasefire is due to expire at the end of Saturday. It has been extended twice already, and we'll see if it'll be extended more, because there are still over 150 missing. Well, not missing. I don't want to say they're lost and now they're found.
There are several factors here, right? So the first one, the most basic one, is how many hostages can Hamas actually produce? We don't know. And quite frankly, we've been claiming that many of the hostages are now being held by other terrorist groups in Gaza, and they need more time to locate them all. So there's a question to be asked about how many hostages can actually be released in the context of this extended deal. But there's also a question to be asked about how this affects Israel's ability to continue the military campaign, because while the military and the various intelligence agencies and other security bodies were supportive of the initial pause and said it was worth the while in order to release the hostages and wouldn't significantly impair the military effort, that may not be true if the truce is extended for a lengthy period of time. It may significantly impair the military's ability to restart its campaign as Hamas uses this time to rearm and regroup. And so those are some very significant concerns that I think Israeli decision makers are facing as they try to decide what to do going forward.
Right. And this at the same exact time that the Israeli public, and in general, the global public, is suddenly throwing Israeli intelligence, one of the best in the world, into question in terms of its validity and level. Israel's intelligence agencies are considered the best in the world, and yet how did we not see October 7th coming? That's the question that keeps repeating itself and has become more and more prevalent as more information has come to light about how intel was gathered, how regularly within the intelligence community, within, for example, the IDF's military intelligence unit, there were people, there were women, ultimately, who warned that something like this was coming. For example, there were, in Hebrew, it's tatzpitaniot, lookouts, who warned that something was coming. There were intelligence officers who warned that there was something being planned. And Why was this not taken into account? Why was Israel ultimately not prepared for that? And that, again, is going to be a question that's going to linger and linger and linger until eventually we get to the end of this war and somebody's going to be have to be held accountable.
Yeah, I mean, look, there are already reports that the head of military intelligence tends to step down at the end of the war. But it seems as though this wasn't any one individual, but rather this conception, or in Hebrew, conceptia, this sort of groupthink that was quite prevalent amongst Israel's military decision makers, all of whom thought that Hamas had been restrained, that it was deterred, that it was mostly concerned with the economic well-being of the people of Gaza. And so any piece of intelligence that strayed from that was disregarded. And I think that that's what we see, in the lead up to October the 7th, and what created this catastrophe. But of course, this is not the time for taking account. There will be plenty of time for that once the dust settles.
I'm not sure I agree with you on that. I did at some point, but I'm not sure I agree with you on that anymore because I think that holding people accountable right now and, applying whatever pressures are necessary on the forces that be in this specific situation. I'm talking about the government, I'm talking about Israel security forces, intel forces. Applying those pressures now may be the correct way to go, simply because that might be what will create change that will allow for more successful results. Or it's hard to say more successful when we're at war and when, our country just went through a massacre. Less devastating results, ultimately, if these pressures are applied. So no, I once would have agreed with you that we can put that aside, wait for this war to be over, and then hold people accountable. But I'm not with you on that anymore. I think the time is coming to hold people accountable for their actions, or more in this case, inaction, and bring them home, if that's what it is. Bring this war to an end. Bring our families, our loved ones, back home safe and sound after they've protected us. Those soldiers that are brave, and those milouimnikim, those reservists, who are, going out of their way, out of their regular lives. What kills me is really these stories, like really heroic stories of people who, were supposed to get married, and then the day before they were supposed to walk down the aisle, they, like, both the bride and the groom get called in for reserve duty. That really, I take my hat off to these people because that's not an easy thing to do, to say the least.
And Tamar, as you were talking about holding people and bodies accountable for, as you said, their action or inaction, I can't help but think of the many humanitarian organizations, including UN bodies, that have been really, I would say, if not silent, engaging in malpractice of their humanitarian missions over the past 2 months.
Hypocritical, really.
I mean, hypocritical to say the least. It feels as though when it comes to these organizations and bodies, Jewish and Israeli lives just don't matter. And it's really devastating to learn that, and especially the organizations that are charged with caring for the world's underprivileged and most vulnerable populations, including in many cases women and children. UN Women and UNICEF have had almost nothing to say about the plight of Israeli women and children being held hostage by Hamas in Gaza. And you have to wonder, why is it that Israeli and Jewish lives matter less to these bodies than other ones?
It's truly a concerning sort of pattern and trend that's been happening, especially this week when we recognized, and the UN specifically recognized, the International Day for the Elimination of Violence Against Women. That's a mouthful, by the way. And on that day, in which the horrific acts that are committed regularly all over the world towards women are recognized and denounced, we see nothing being said about the horrific, horrific sexual assaults and rapes that were committed against Israeli women on October 7th. And that, for me, is just, the last straw, really.
It's, I mean, what's so striking about it is not only their inaction and silence, but that in many cases there are individuals, and quite a few of them, who've been denying that these atrocities even took place. And there was this There's this video that's circulating of a town hall meeting in in California, in which one speaker after another gets up and talks about how it's all Israeli propaganda, and in fact, it was Israel who killed its own citizens, and one thing after another. And you're watching, you're being like, are these people on the same planet as I am? Like, are they working off the same set of facts? Are they operating in the same reality? And it sometimes feels as though the answer is simply no. And that's just the most devastating part of it, that it's almost like there's no way to get through to these people. They have been totally brainwashed into believing this alternate reality.
Yeah, and I think that's definitely going to be highlighted this coming week when the women's organization, Israeli women's organization, Bonot Alternativa, Building an Alternative, goes to speak at the United Nations specifically about this issue and this double standard that Israeli women are facing. We're joined now by Moran Zer Katzenstein, who is the founder of Bonot Alternativa. She created the organization at first 3 years ago in response to the horrific gang rape that occurred in Eilat to a teenage girl. And since then, the organization, since October 7th, has turned all its efforts to helping those affected by this horrific massacre and by the war, namely the women who were assaulted. They're going to speak at the United Nations. Let's go over to that interview. I'm joined now by Moran Zer Katzenstein, the founder of the organization Bonot Alternativa, Building an Alternative. I'll let her introduce the organization herself. Moran, thank you for joining us today.
Hi, thanks. Thank you for having me.
So tell us a little bit about Bonot Alternativa, please.
So I founded Bonot Alternativa 3 years ago. There was a horrifying gang rape of a young girl in Eilat, and I felt like I can't keep silent about it. So even though I didn't have any activist, feminist background, I decided I want to have a strikes all over the country, and I opened the Bonot Alternativa WhatsApp group. And we did. We held over 30 demonstrations around the country and one big demonstration protest in Rabin Square. And ever since, we did all kinds of activities to promote women's rights and to protect women. And at the beginning of last year, we were announced to the judicial overhaul. And one thing that we were very clear about is that this government might be harming women's rights. And this is something we couldn't allow. So we joined the protest, Red Women, with the Handmaid's Tale display. And we were very active in protecting women's rights. And this is the thing that we were focusing on. And right now we are over 150,000 women in over 80 cities in Israel and 15 cities around the globe. And in October 7th, on 9 in the morning, we had a conversation in our management. We understood what's happening, and I told my team, there is no protest anymore. We are at war, and we just move the entire organization to do one thing, to focus on one thing, everything we can actually to focus on the help of the Israeli people and civilians, of course, on focusing on women. And we mobilized our 150,000 members to care for the evacuees, for women.
What does that translate to in action?
So actually, we opened 50 operation centers across Israel, where we assessed the needs of individuals, of families, of communities in shock. And each center has its own story. I can give you some examples if you want.
Sure. Yeah, go ahead.
So for example, in the town of Netanya, we took over 10 hotels in collaboration with the municipality, and we are taking care there in the needs of the families. Part of the things that we were doing there, for example, and this is something I didn't imagine that we will do, we opened 8 kindergarten, and that was in collaboration with the Ministry of Education and the municipality of Netanya. So, and we opened the kindergartens for the evacuees. In Tel Aviv, we took over the Cinematheque and opened a regional distribution center, which Bonote women operate. In the town of Rehovot, for example, Bonot managed 2,000 volunteers and run three centers that distribute thousands of items for families, for soldiers. So there is like every center that we're talking about has its own story, amazing things that's happening. So this is like generally in the entire country, but there are also specific campaigns and a project that we are focusing in women. For example, the spotters, we adopted the IDF spotters. We know that those units of women soldiers are on the front lines.
You're referring to the IDF lookouts, the ones who actually warned their
exactly.
commanders about an imminent attack and were scoffed off, to put it nicely.
Yeah, you don't even have to put it nicely, but yes. And they were also slaughtered, raped, kidnapped. And some of their friends had to go back to work. And we took care of them in every way. You think even in supply, because some of them had to stay more in the army and didn't have even like elementary clothing, hygienic product, whatever. We supplied everything they need. But in a more wide manner, we are in touch with them and with their mothers, and we understand what they need. And now we are supporting them both physically, but both mentally, because we understand that what happened here, they need to be, they need us. And we are funding everything they need in those terms as well. So this is also another project that we're doing. And another thing that we know is that in hard times, women-owned businesses are the first to collapse. So we are helping women, self-employed women, to keep their businesses. We are launching an e-commerce marketplace, the biggest one, with hundreds of businesses for women. And we are supporting them and building them websites so they can still continue their business even if they are away. So everything we're doing is very much how we can support civilians, but focusing on women.
And in the context of what happened on October 7th, as you mentioned, the horrific, horrific massacre, but specifically also the rape and horrible, horrible abuse that many women faced on that day at the hands of Hamas operatives. What is Bonot Alternativa moving forward specifically in that regard today?
So as I mentioned, Bonot Alternativa has groups all around the country. Yesterday, we held a demonstration all around the world, and one big one in New York, in front of the UN. And there will be another one, bigger one even, on the day that we will talk in the UN. There's going to be a conference over there. And also we...
So tell us a little bit about what's going to happen then, please.
So first of all, I want you to know several things. First of all, it's a well-known event. I found out because I didn't know that in areas of conflict, using women's body as a weapon, committing crimes against humanity is very common. And it was known that in Israel, it does, and in the Arab, in the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, it doesn't happen because we don't use it and it doesn't happen. And that was the first time that this kind of action happened. And this is something that we can't allow to become a norm. And once the UN women and once the women organization are keeping silent, it's a form of consent. It's a consent to what happened here, as if it's a legitimate part of the resistance, and it's not. Rape is not in no way is part of resistance. And this is something that we are demanding them to speak up and to talk about it, because if they won't speak up, their silence is consent. It's not just the UN. It's the UN Women and it's other women organizations and it's activist women around the globe that only 6 months ago hugged us and were so proud of us and our activity and our fight for equal rights in Israel. And that we, the fact that we brought thousands of women to the streets fighting for women rights. And right now they are silent. And this is something we can accept.
I see. And so there's a delegation from Bonot Alternativa heading to the US. Is that correct?
There is a delegation heading to the US and I'm part of it as Bonot Alternativa.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much for your work. It truly sounds like something amazing. I wonder what the stance is of Bonot Alternativa regarding the circumstances that were created due to the war. Families have been locked up inside or moved in extremely tough situations. Families that are in complex situations or have a tendency towards or might even be violent homes. What exactly is the stance of an organization such as yours on how to handle this extreme change?
So actually, the first thing is to add to all the things that you said, we have the ministry, Ben-Gvir, that is just giving out weapons. And we know that that's very dangerous in violent families. And unfortunately, the government doesn't do their basic checkups before giving weapons. And I'm not saying that we don't need those weapons for our safety, but we're demanding the country, the government, to do like the basic checkups so women won't feel terrorized in their own home. And we are already hearing about it. And it's a matter of time, unfortunately, that those weapons will be used against women. So this is one thing. And the second thing is on the 25th of November was the Elimination Day against violence, against the violence against women. And during this entire week, we held an online conference, a very big one, with all the women organizations that specified in different aspects of those of this subject. And we held three lectures a day talking about it, bringing more and more attention. And I think this is part of what we as Bonot Alternativa do. It's a platform. We use our traffic. We use the thousands of women that we have to give them the information and also to help other women organizations bring their specific information they have.
All right. Moran Zer Katzenstein, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Have you listened to the Jerusalem Post podcast Travel Edition? I'm David Harris, and together with my co-host Mark Gordon, we bring you the best from the world of travel and tourism.
We have people who literally fly to Park City just to do the ski minion.
And it has that heavenly taste that you don't really find nowadays in the market.
When was the last time you went to a restaurant and they bought you a picnic basket about eight courses in?
The Dracula tour. That's a very unusual honeymoon option, really.
The Jerusalem Post podcast Travel Edition brings you the joys of travel and tourism. So why not subscribe today wherever you get your podcasts?
Cheers, Mark.
Cheers, David. Ooh.
Thank you for joining us on the Jerusalem Post podcast. If you liked this episode, please make sure to like, subscribe, and comment down below on the Jerusalem Post website what you like to hear next. You can reach out to us at podcast@jpost.com, and you can stream every previous episode and all the future ones on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Be well.